Oh, not Jewish, Mahatma Gandhi, but a friend of my center. I have pictures of people like Gandhi in my center, and when I talk about them, I put my hand on them and say, our friend Mahatma Gandhi. But I bring Mahatma Gandhi up for a variety of reasons, because one of them being, he wrote a letter to the Jews of Germany in 1938. By the way, Gandhi wrote a lot of letters. I want to get his collected works for my center. It's over 100 volumes of letters, basically. And Gandhi was surrounded by Jews. And there's an interesting book titled Gandhi's Jewish Friends. That's the name of the book. And he wrote this letter to the Jews of Germany and said to the Jews of Germany, hey, it's difficult, I know. You're being oppressed. They're denying you your rights. You gotta protest against that denial. Nonviolently, you'll suffer, some of you will die, but ultimately, the Germans will be converted to your humanity and you will be reintegrated into society. Gandhi was wrong. He didn't understand the violence of the Nazis. The second part of the letter was about Jewish settlers in Palestine. Gandhi said, hey, no problem. You have a right to live wherever you want to live, but you do not have a right to create a community that displaces the Palestinian Arabs. If you do, you will be correctly seen as colonialist and imperialist. Martin Buber, who was one of the most famous Jews of the 20th century, a Viennese Jew, who was expelled from Germany in 1938 and went to Jerusalem and argued for a binational state. He was a Zionist, but a homeland or spiritual Zionist, which meant he believed that there should be a collective of Jews in Palestine because that was linked to our origins. But it cannot displace Palestinian Arabs. We need to live together. So he was a homeland and spiritual Zionist. He was upset with Gandhi. He liked Gandhi. He was a follower of Gandhi in some ways, but responded to his letter from Jerusalem saying to Gandhi that he didn't understand the violence of the Nazis. Buber was right. And that he did understand what Gandhi said about the development of a state for Jews in Palestine, that it would be correctly seen as colonial and imperial. But Buber didn't want state. And in fact, what very few Jews know is that one of the most famous Jews of the 20th century was against the birth of a Jewish state, and he was a Zionist. Dietrich Bonhoeffer in the church where I criticize Christians, I have to bring him up as a Christian who gave his life to fight Hitler. Very interesting, going back to Gandhi for a second, he asked the Indian people to burn their British clothes. And when they did, he said, we would burn our shame. Gandhi said, when you burn your British clothes, you burn your shame. The question for Jews is, what shame do we need to burn? Now, Bonhoeffer talked about cheap grace, grace from God where you didn't do anything, you didn't have to do anything, and costly grace. A costly grace was to do something, and yes, you would be blessed by God if you did justice, but you would suffer for it. The question we Jews have today is, what is costly grace for us, or costly Jewishness? Because in many parts of Jewish history, Jewishness has been quite costly. But now it's become kind of cheap. It's upward mobility. It's status. It's connection. Sometimes it's wealth in the service of empire. What is costly Jewishness? Oh, there's Edward Said, great Palestinian scholar and advocate. He's a friend of mine. And yes, here he is already sick with the illness that would take his life, and he was strikingly handsome, and he knew it. He was a prince, loved it. When I would see him talk in front of Palestinians, they would bow before him like an old Hollywood movie, and he loved it, and even though what he told me was stupid, I said, right, yes, I know that Edward, but I knew he loved it. He wrote a book on titled Orientalism about how the West sees the East in very racist terms. And he was thinking of himself being seen by the West and others like him. And it's interesting when you look at the question of Israel-Palestine, the way Jews look at Palestinians and Arabs, it's very Orientalist, and I have to say, very racist. And that is even among some progressive Jews like Tikkun and Michael Lerner and Arthur Waskow, good Jews who are arguing against the Jewish establishment. But if you look at their writing, they're very patronizing. There's a lot of colonial and imperial elements to Jewish identity today, and a lot of racism. Now, another thing about Said, he argued against any essentialism. He didn't think Palestine was important in the grand scheme of things, but it was to Palestinians. And he didn't think of a Palestinian identity or a Jewish identity. All identities were fluid. But in fact, if you look at his life, especially after Oslo, as he was dying, when the Palestinians signed that agreement, Said went ballistic. He never recovered from it. Because the great arguer against identity felt a deep sense of Palestinian identity, and he couldn't believe the Palestinians were acting like any other people had acted in history, their leaders selling them out, because he thought Palestinians were better. So my comment here is that often we see the struggle of Israel and Palestine as the universal values of Palestinians against this particular and violent Jewish particularity, but actually it's a struggle of particularities, and Said was one of those particulars. And here's Noam Chomsky. I have trouble drawing crowds, as you can see, but it's part of my faith, it's okay. And when I was in London a few weeks ago, I got there right as Noam Chomsky got there, and believe me, he outdrew me. You know, I'm talking to 50 people, lovely people. And he's got an auditorium that is completely full, and he has overflows at 6 universities where they're going to have him on the screen. I mean, you know, just blowing them out. And he deserves it, of course. And the reason that people flock to Chomsky, and a lot of Palestinians, many, is that he's a universal figure. But, oh, so Jewish. He grew up in a completely Jewish home. You can't understand Chomsky without understanding his Jewishness, which he never talks about or rarely talks about. He only talks about it in interviews, never writes about it. And by the way, Chomsky, although he doesn't talk about it usually now, is a Zionist. A homeland Zionist, not a spiritual one in the sense of Buber, but basically believes that Jews can be a collective in Palestine, but should not oppress the Palestinian people. And now he's a two-stater, but it's interesting, again, with Said and Chomsky, the two giants, Said no longer alive, but Chomsky and Said, the two giants, two universal value types, seen as universal value types, but, oh, intensely particular, Palestinian and Jewish. And the beautiful Hannah Arendt, with a cigarette in her hand, which was part of, you know, like Ken Moon, he's always seen with a cigarette in his hand. You can't be European without that, even if you die later. It looks terrific. Hannah Arendt is another universal figure, but she had to flee the Nazis, and about 80-90% of her writing, if you look at it, is on Jews. She was vilified by the Jewish community for writing on the Eichmann trial, vilified. But in 1947-48, she was writing on Palestine, And she also was a homeland Zionist and a binationalist. And if you look at her writing, and you can see it, there's a new edition of her Jewish writings out. She is prophetic about what would happen to the Jews of the Middle East if Israel became a state. And what would happen to Jews worldwide if Israel became a state? Let me tell you what she said. For Israel, she said, if Israel was created as a Jewish state, there would be a perpetual war in the Middle East. And that Israel, as a state, would be completely militarized, consuming the values that would come from a homeland Zionism, the revival of Hebrew, the kibbutz, other Jewish experiments, including an education, which then could be given to the world. All of that would be overshadowed by the militarism of the state that had to fight a perpetual war. But she also believed that Jewishness in the diaspora would become militarized as well, and that the establishment would beat down any Jew who showed a prophetic streak in regard to Jewish life. She was completely right. And we experience this today, even on my tour. Establishment Jews, what I call Constantinian Jews, and here I talk about Constantinian Jews in reference to Constantinian Christianity. That is, when Christianity went from being a small Jewish sect to the religion of the empire in the 4th century and beyond, where then everybody had to be a Christian. And Christianity blessed the empire, and the empire blessed Christianity, and they went hand in hand around the world, right? One of the most violent traditions in the history of the world. Well, we have a Constantinian Judaism today, not because Jews or Judaism is the majority, but because we've linked with empire. And the resources of our community, from intellectual work, business, money, lobbying, everything that we produce in abundance is oriented toward the empire, so we can be blessed by it. And therefore Israel can be protected. So Hannah Arendt had it right in 1947 and 48, although she was almost driven out of Jewish life, or in many ways was, by the early 60s. Well, this is an unknown person, not unknown to me, but unknown to you, Oren Ben-Dor. I met him in Boston. He's a Jewish Israeli, and one of the most sensitive men I've ever met. And I bring him up, not because he's famous, he's a philosopher whom I can't understand, and I'm assuming you can't either, but we know it's important. As one student once said to me, to Dr. Ellis, I didn't understand the thing you said, but I knew it was important. I thought, okay, fair enough. How about that for an evaluation? I thought, I'll take it, you know? He's left Israel permanently. What, about 750,000 or a million Israelis who have left Israel permanently? That's interesting. That's a high percentage of the Israeli population, of Jews who have returned, right, from exile to the land where they are supposed to be, and have now left. What does this Israeli diaspora mean in terms of Jewish history? Here's what I think it's about. Everyone has their own personal story. But Oren told me that as a kid, his father used to take him to the Galilee to walk out in the beauty of the land. But then he realized he was walking on destroyed Palestinian villages, and he just couldn't do it. See, it may be that Jews ultimately just can't do what it takes to oppress another people permanently. And that's what those 750,000 to a million Israelis outside of Israel are about, from my perspective. They couldn't do it. Ah, here's my teacher, Richard Rubenstein. He can do it. Actually, he didn't do it, but he thought about doing it. He wrote the book After Auschwitz in 1966. It's now a classic. I studied with him in 1970, and that's my copy, plus $2.45, which is not what my book was. I'm not saying my book is equal either. But he raised some important questions which we have to consider so we understand that Jews who support Israel aren't just idiots. Rubinstein said that the God who protected us, the covenant which said that God had obligations to us as well, was absent in Auschwitz. And so was humanity as we died. But Rubinstein saw Auschwitz as a splitting point in world history, but also for Jews, especially, about who we could trust. And in the end, the only people we could trust were ourselves. That's for Rubinstein. And this he outlines in, among other books, The Cutting of History, which he published in 1975, and which I still use in my Holocaust class. It's 98 pages, one of the most power-packed books you could ever read, about the Holocaust as a paradigm for the 20th century, not just for Jews, and how it's part of our future, not just for Jews. Long story. But for us, it's important that Rubinstein says that the 20th century is a century of mass death, and that history is a cycle of violence and atrocity. You either have power and you win, or you don't have power and you lose. We've lost. Now we need power. The necessity of Jewish power, never to lose again. And for him, it's Israel. And if you don't understand that, you can't understand the mainstream Jewish conversation, they don't say, as Richard Rubinstein says, and they haven't read it either. But this sense that Jewish life can't survive without power, and no one's going to tell us or reduce us to powerlessness again, that's a mainstream understanding of the Jewish life. Some of you have heard of Elie Wiesel. How many? This is his autobiographical story of his time in Nike, where he lost his family. He's in Auschwitz, where he lost his family. And there's a new translation, but here it's very interesting. It became a bestseller in the United States, I don't know about Canada. Again, it sold millions of copies. And in fact, in my class we use it as well. But by the time the students come into my class, they've read it three or four times in grade school, in junior high and high school. They've all had classes in the Holocaust, mandated by the state. And here, his new translation got a big boost when he was on the Oprah show. How many of you know of the Oprah show in Canada? Okay, now I want to make a disclaimer. I'd like to be on the Oprah show, okay? Because it's an automatic million sale, or quick sale, okay? And then I come back here, no problem, but I'd like to be on the Oprah show. I don't think I'm going to get there. By the way, Elie Wiesel took over to Auschwitz. You can find that DVD. I think it's on our website. I have it. It's a very interesting dialogue between Oprah and Wiesel at Auschwitz. And he has invited her officially to come to Israel with him. But I don't know where that stands now. But there's the Oprah's book club seal. And you wonder, this terrible event, so terrible that even after reading about it since I was 18 and studying it, there's always something that I come across which I can't believe. But there's also a trivialization of the Holocaust. Trivialization. Oprah's book club. Oprah's book club. And when we as Jews use the Holocaust over against others, as a blunt instrument, we trivialize it. It's not a question of whether it happened. Yeah, it did. Yes, it did. I'm talking about the way the Holocaust functions now in relation to Jewish power. Always try to be local, the great Canadian, although born in Germany, Emil Fackenheim, how many of you know of him? He was at the University of Toronto for a long time. Then lived his last years in Israel, died in Israel. By the way, it's interesting, somebody in Montreal told me that sent me today a news report. His son was almost denied Israeli citizenship because he got a divorce. It's a long story, they got a divorce. His mother was born Christian and was a Christian until later in life when she converted to Judaism. And there was some question about this conversion. He was almost denied Israeli citizenship. It's since been reversed. But Fackenheim said that we don't know, we don't know about God after Auschwitz. But in the 67 war, when everything was on the line for Jews, according to Fackenheim, Jews responded with a victory, which meant they were responding to the commanding voice of Auschwitz, not Sinai, because we can't hear that voice anymore, but the commanding voice of the Holocaust. And there he issued a new commandment, or he believed the Jewish people issued it, Orthodox Jews believing that there are 613 commandments issued by God, but we don't know about God now. So he believed that there was a 614th commandment issued by the Jewish people. Here it is. We're going to survive. Not to survive is to make Hitler the victor. He became very famous in Jewish life, sometimes quoted in Jewish circles outside of the academy. But again, this can be heard in normative establishment Jewish discourse. Now, of course, we could ask the question, what is Hitler's victory? It could be the wiping out of the Jewish people. That would make sense, yes. That would be a victory for Hitler, because that's what he wanted. But we could also do Hitler's work by perverting our own ethics. And that's why if he's going to issue a commandment, I've issued one too, the 615th commandment. If we get to it, I'll share it. Well, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., fascinating. Memory, testimony, witness, but also a tribute to Jewish power, because in Washington, D.C., in the Capitol, on the Mall, the most popular museum in Washington, D.C. now is about an event that didn't happen in America. Did you ever think about that? Obviously, the Holocaust didn't happen in America. And that museum was established before the African-American Museum, which did happen in America, or the Native American Museum, which did happen in America. It's still, the Martin Luther King Memorial still hasn't been built. So the question here is not should we pay tribute to those who died in the Holocaust, of course, but how does this museum function? Now, at the end of the museum, when you exit, you see the Washington Monument. And the idea is that this event, which didn't happen in America, couldn't happen in America because of our liberal democracy. That's the lesson of the Holocaust for the visitors to the museum, or at least what the museum architects wanted to be the lesson. And of course, there's nothing about Palestinian suffering in that museum. Now, we might say, well, there shouldn't be, because the Holocaust is about Jewish suffering, but there are all sorts of lessons in the museum. What if the museum ended with pictures of faces of Palestinians? Then the museum would function to memorialize the victims of the Holocaust, but also would have a different lesson, or maybe the same lesson, but it would illustrate aspects of the needed lesson more concretely, because for Jews today, the widow, the orphan, the poor, and the stranger are the Palestinians, aren't they? And so that's why the Jewish prophetic voice talks about them. That's who they are for us today. But at the Holocaust Memorial Museum, they're absent. I don't want to denigrate these Holocaust theologians. That's way too simple. Rabbi Irving Greenberg is a Holocaust theologian. In 1974, he wrote the most powerful quote about the Holocaust or the meaning of it in relation to God that I've ever read. After the Holocaust, no statement, theological or otherwise, should be made that would not be credible in the presence of the burning children. If you want to speak about God, even in this church, go ahead. If it would make sense to a burning child of the Holocaust, if not, be silent. And I think it's fair to say that all the seminaries, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, would have to shut down, because what do you say? What would make sense to a burning child? But here's another point. After the Holocaust, no statement, theological or otherwise. So we could say, maybe, after the Holocaust, no statement, theological or political, theological or military, theological or economic, theological or cultural, that does not make sense in the presence of the burning children, shouldn't be made. Now, I'm not going to sing for you tonight. I do sing. And I write poetry. I'm not going to write any poetry. I'm not going to recite any of my poetry. But in 1988, I wrote a poem about Palestinian suffering, about the Palestinian children I visited in the hospitals around Jerusalem. Most of them were brain dead, paralyzed for life. And I started out with that statement. And I asked the question in the poem, whether Palestinian children were burning, and whether those children who were burning were also our own. Sticking with the question of faith for just a moment, don't worry, I'll get off it. Very important for my Christian evangelical students who believe they're theists, they believe in Jesus Christ, and if you don't, you're lost. But Greenberg says, after Auschwitz, we now have to speak of moment faiths, moments when Redeemer and vision of redemption are present, interspersed with times when the flames and smoke of burning children blot out faith, though it flickers again. There's a theism in all of us, Greenberg says, and an atheism. It's just a matter of which is more frequent. Now, I got in a little trouble, I want to tell you, on this tour, where one of the women, Jewish women, thought I had said that Jewish atheists are superficial, and that really got her angry, because that's her religion. Atheism. And I said, no, I said that Jewish atheists can be superficial, like believers who know everything about God can be superficial. It's really in between. And as one Jewish philosopher, theologian said, in his early 20s he didn't believe in anything until he lived among those who didn't believe in anything. And therefore he realized he believed in something. And everyone who works for justice, in my opinion, believes in something more than themselves. Now, this is 1974, a long time ago, right? In this essay, Greenberg gives us two warnings. He says, the victims ask us above anything else not to allow the creation of another matrix of values that might sustain another attempt at genocide. He doesn't say genocide against Jews. It seems to be genocide against anyone. So never against Jews. Yes, that's part of Holocaust theology. But in the beginning, never against anyone. Two, that's dropped out. That's dropped out. And now it's much more never again against Jews. But the others, that's less. But here's the other one. The Holocaust cannot be used for triumphalism. Its moral challenge must also be applied to Jews. As a mainstream Jewish Holocaust theologian, that's about Israel. Don't use the Holocaust against Palestinians. Now, the last original essay about Holocaust theology or Holocaust consciousness was published by Irving Greenberg in 1988 as a response to the criticism of Israel's crushing of the Palestinian uprising. And for those of you who recall that time period, it was a big uproar in the Jewish community when they saw pictures of these beatings and read news articles of these beatings of Israeli soldiers against Palestinians, and in the world. And Greenberg responded and said, look, we used to be the great critiquers of power, the prophets, when we didn't have power. But now we have power, and we can't afford the prophetic. The prophetic has to take a back seat. We're going through the difficult phase of normalization, he calls it, where we as Jews will begin to do things against others that look an awfully lot, a lot, like things that were done against us. Now, we shouldn't applaud that, but we shouldn't go ballistic about it. We have to be very calm in our power. We have to correct the mistakes we make, but we can never criticize power to the point where we lose that power and thus become vulnerable to another in the Holocaust. You see, in all of this mainstream Jewish thinking around the Holocaust is not only past, it's part of our future. If we let our guard down for 1 second, they think, we're done. So in Greenberg, of course, here's the other part of Greenberg. There's never been a time in Jewish history where Jews haven't thought themselves to be exceptional. I said thought. I'm not saying we are. And I'm not saying we're not. But never in Jewish history has Jewishness been explained as just like anyone else. It's always been explained as exceptional. That's why in the biblical narrative, these slaves can be the center of the world. But the Egyptian Empire didn't figure that, did they? But Israel did. So Greenberg wants to say, has to say, prophetic, take a back seat, but can't say, we're going to be like everyone else. So what does he do? He asks the question, how much better can Jews be after the Holocaust than everyone else and survive? That's his question. So we start out with 100%. Of course, you can't be 100% better and survive. 90%, 80%, 70, 60, 50, 40, 30, you think maybe 20, 10. We Jews can be 10% better than everyone else and survive. If you think I'm kidding, read it. Okay. How much time do we have left? I just want to touch on this. This PowerPoint can go on for a long time, okay? So I'm just going to wrap it up. I've talked about Holocaust Israel-identified Jews, what I call Constantinian Jews. Remember, Jews linked to empire, and they have their reasons. Because when we weren't linked with empire, we were slaughtered. That's their view. The only way to survive in this kind of world is to link with empire, and they do. And they beat down anyone who tries to break that link. Now, progressive Jews, how many of you know of Tikkun, Michael Lerner? How many of you get his emails? How many of you read them? I read them very carefully. They're amazing. It takes some time. But here's my point. Progressive Jews are Jews who say, yes, the Holocaust is important, and yes, Israel is important. We were innocent in our suffering, and we were innocent in our empowerment in Israel, just like Constantinian Jews. See, Jews are innocent, Jews are better, even in our power. They agree with that, but something went wrong after the 67 war, when Jews began to settle Palestinian land. That's when things got wrong, and we have to rectify that. And the way we rectify that wrong is to withdraw from the settlements, or at least some of them, we never know exactly what it is, and give Palestinians some freedom and keep them away from us so we can reclaim our innocence and go on with our life. Now, it's interesting, when President Obama went to Cairo, if you remember, Prime Minister Netanyahu, just a week later, announced that he was for a two-state solution. A little rhetorical, I think. And the way he announced what a two-state, what a Palestinian state would be, on the West Bank, but not completely theirs, some representation in Jerusalem, but not their own place. A demilitarized state, because after all, Palestinians can't be trusted with an army. His outline was basically the progressive Jewish understanding of the solution of the Israel-Palestine crisis. What I'm saying here is that progressive Jews that have established the thinkable parameters of dissent for Jews are really the left wing of Constantinian Judaism. It's one of my favorite formulations, and it really bothers progressive Jews because they think they're in a civil war with Constantinian Judaism, and I think that progressive Jews, because they beat down anything to the left of them forever, and those thoughts to the left of them might have gotten to the center of what we really need to do, that they have been, consciously or unconsciously, you can make your own choice, enablers of the destruction of Palestine. Because they've limited the debate so much that it's inconsequential. Now, if we had four more hours, I would tell you the full story, but I may come back on that. Let's see a few other progressive Jews, and then I'm gonna go to the third group. Arthur Waskow, you may not know of him, but he's well known in the States. Oh, Cornel West, he's not Jewish. How many of you know of Cornel West? Great guy, I know him, lovely guy, terrific guy, I'm not getting down on him, but you know what he did? In the 1980s and 90s, he linked with Tikkun. And he started doing events with them. And published a book with Michael Lerner. He made a tragic error and helped to bury the Jewish left that was left at the left, which wasn't left at all. Okay, last group. Oh, no, let's go. I'll talk about that. Next. Okay, now go back. The rebirth of the prophetic and truth telling. I'll be very quick. In 2000, in the second Palestinian uprising, the Jewish left left the left. You notice, all the Jewish leftist movements, like Peace Now, basically disappeared. And they disappeared into the place where they should have been, or they were, Constantinian Judaism. But there were other Jews who got sick, fed up with this false civil war between Constantinian Jews and progressive Jews, and said, it's a hypocrisy. This is what I call Jews of conscience. Here are some of them. There are three women I highlight, and it's interesting, they're all children of Holocaust survivors. Sarah Roy at Harvard, Center for Middle Eastern Studies, a world expert on Gaza. She's a child of Holocaust survivors. Amira Haas, I'm sure you've heard of her, did you know she's a child of Holocaust survivors? That's pretty interesting, isn't it? Israeli journalist who lives among Palestinians. Patty Epstein, who was on the Kinder transport, a child that got out, but her parents were lost to the Nazis. Next. She was recently on a ship to Gaza and has protested many times against Israeli policies. Here's a group that pickets a local synagogue in Michigan. Boy, those Sabbath worshipers are really, you know, they go there every Friday or Saturday. some Israeli soldiers that refused to serve in the West Bank of Gaza, Ilan Pappe, who wrote, an Israeli historian, next. I'm sure you've seen this book, or maybe The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. By the way, the narrative that Ilan and myself and others have worked on for years to show that Israel is not innocent and that Jews aren't innocent and there's a prophetic voice, we won. That will be in history, and that will be known to all, including Jews. But we've lost everything politically. Interesting, huh? We won the narrative. Now you ask yourself, if they've won the politics, why are they so concerned with someone like me talking to you? Who cares if they won? Why would the Jewish establishment have people follow someone like me with no power? Because Jews always think they're better. We're getting back to that, right? They want to win politically, but they also want to be better. Okay, final two slides. Oh, Jeff Alpert, you've heard him. He draws bigger crowds than I do. Noam Chomsky. Okay. Well, let's go through this. Just go until I tell you. It's another interesting story we're going to find. Okay, what's that there? Oh, these are the Ten Commandments. Prophetic group in Philadelphia. You shall not kill, you will not starve others, you will not torture, you will not assassinate, you will not covet Palestinian land, you will not demolish homes, you will not uproot trees, you will not block ambulances, you will not besiege, and the occupation. Hey, a new Ten Commandments. Thank you very much.